Come on, mothers, throughout the land. Pack your boys off to Vietnam. Come on, fathers, don't hesitate. Send them off before it's too late. Be the first one on your block to have your boy come home in a box. And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7, open up the pearly gates. Well, ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die.
Okay, started off with a bang there. That's Country Joe McDonald, I Feel Like I'm Fixing to Die Rag, written in 1967. And that doesn't really apply to my first guest as much as my second guest, but wanted to get you in the mood for a little 60s there. I hope I have on the phone with me today Benny Gutierrez. Benny graduated Butte College in 2020 with degrees in journalism and social and behavioral science. He's an advocate for social justice, and he started a club for the formerly incarcerated on campus and continues to support this segment of the population through his post-release work in the community. He, as I mentioned, is a formerly incarcerated social activist. He's the founder of Ascending Scholars of Butte College and the co-curator at the Greenhouse Studio and Gallery in Chico, California. Welcome, Benny.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear from you again. I met you at the now defunct Blackbird Cafe, and you were on the radio one other time, and we talked about formerly incarcerated students at Butte College. Can you give us an update about, during this time of distance learning, how things are going for students at Butte?
Well, it's been difficult, to say the least, for every student, for every segment of the population, but in particular for those who were formerly incarcerated. It's been kind of difficult to just to keep that core of people together through Zooms and social distancing, but we've managed to do just that. We're resilient. We're resilient people.
Yeah. I think everybody has to be now, but especially people who have gone through what they've gone through in terms of being taken out of society for so long, and for being ostracized, and so many other things that happens to incarcerated people who return. Now, you're working on a project with a care package through a GoFundMe project. Can you tell us about that, Benny?
Okay, so... So, I am very thankful for the many programs and volunteers that came in to the prisons where I was at, and some of the fellas that are still back there doing the hard work. And it's certainly tough for them now during this time, during this quarantine. A lot of them are coming down with COVID, and just everything's just thrown out of whack for them. And so, you know, I decided to do a GoFundMe to pay for care packages. And so my girlfriend and I, we've been sitting down in our free time and fulfilling all these orders. And the response from the community and for the GoFundMe was amazing. We raised over $1,200. And, yeah, so we've been able to provide the guys inside with a little bit of extra food and coffee and cosmetics, you know, things that they would ordinarily have access to if they weren't on quarantine. So, yeah, we've been helping out with that. Sure.
That's good. And so is this through the commissary of a certain prison, or, you know, people that you formerly knew, or who exactly are the people you've directed your project toward?
Yeah, so to guys that I know, who will be good stewards of the packages that are sent in. And so, like, one guy in particular, I sent them a ton of coffee, like Top Ramen, all the staples of the food in there, and then, you know, deodorants and, you know, things of that nature. And what he did was he sat there and made these little smaller care packages, and each one he put like 5 ramens and like a bag of coffee and all these things. And And he went around, this guy made me tear up. He went around to people who were, were ostracized in there and who had no one, and lifers who all their friends and families forgotten about them. And he just went and tied these secretly to their doors and put a message on there that said, from God. Like, it made me tear up we've just been giving them to people who I know in there who are outstanding gentlemen and with integrity, and they're making smaller care packages, bursting them in the prison.
This must be a place, low-level offenders, to have that mobility and to be able to send stuff in, because I know I'm doing Christmas cards for people in the Yuba County Jail, and you can't even send a Christmas card in an envelope that's not white. I mean, they're so restrictive. So can you be clearer about who exactly this is, where you're talking about?
Yeah, this is at Valley State Prison.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And there's a big difference between county jail and prison. And inside CDCR, you have more freedoms, more access to programs. In the county jail, you have nothing. And yeah, even in our county, Butte County Jail, like, you can't receive mail with stamps on them, and like, they're just very particular. But here at Valley State, at Valley State Prison, even now during quarantine, like, they can receive care packages.
Well, that's good. And so, yeah, I know at Yuba, at the Yuba County Jail, people can get money orders, and then they can use those in the commissary. We've been particularly worried about them being able to access soap, because the soap they're provided is just a teeny bit of soap, and during COVID, you want to be washing your hands more often. I don't even know if they sell masks, but at any rate, I've been following that at Yuba, so I'm so glad to hear this. How do people participate? Is it still open?
I posted it on Facebook, and I believe it remains open until there's a certain level of inactivity, but people can certainly find the post. My name is Benny Gutierrez. I'm on Facebook. I think you might have shared it.
Mm-hmm.
The GoFundMe, yeah. So it's still technically open, and as long as there are any funds in there, we're going to continue sending care packages for sure.
Another clarification: Are you Benito Gutierrez on Facebook or Benny?
No, on Benny.
Okay, because you use both handles. Okay. All right, so last thing on that, if you don't mind, for us older people, what is the address to participate in this?
Oh, so if anybody wants to send a money order, right, they can send it to Greenhouse Studios, Greenhouse Studio and Gallery, and we're at 915 Pomona Avenue here in Chico, California, 95928.
Or even a check, perhaps, made out.
Money order.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. All right. That's great.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for your work, for not forgetting those that are still in. I think it must be a really hard time of year for folks.
Yes, especially now during the holidays.
Mm-hmm. And under COVID with so much worry.
Yeah.
So I'm speaking with Benny Gutierrez. He is a local activist, and one of the things that you're working on now that I wanted to hear more about is the Ascending Scholars program at Sixth Street Center for Youth. Can you tell us first about what Sixth Street is?
So Sixth Street Center is a center here in downtown Chico who assists young people experiencing homelessness and access to safety and support and basic necessities, people who are unhoused and living on the streets. And so they're their own entity. And I really like what they're doing, and I really like to assist them and help them whenever possible. So our club, Ascending Scholars, it's a club on campus at Butte College. And we decided this year we would like to help them again. And so we just started a winter necessities drive. And so that's our connection with Sixth Street. Yeah.
And the Ascending Scholars Group is made up of the formerly incarcerated. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am. Formerly incarcerated and system-impacted students. Anyone who had maybe had a family member who was incarcerated at one point, or just those advocates who want to support our club. Everyone's welcome to participate in the club that has, you know, we're all of the same mind. Hmm. But for the most part, we're made up of formerly incarcerated students, yes.
Okay. Well, it's really important work because this Sixth Street Center is available to youth under 18, and a lot of people, when part ways with the foster care system, become homeless, and they need these connections so badly. And so I hope that people will support the center itself. I don't know how they're financed. I know they're associated with Youth for Change, which is a foster care organization.
Yeah.
But tell us about how people could assist your project for the youth at the Sixth Street Center here in Chico.
Okay, so like you said, people can go on their website at the Sixth Street Center for Youth website and support them anytime throughout the year. But for this drive specifically, we're asking for donations of like high protein non-perishables, rain and winter jackets, tents, tarps, hand warmers, belts. They need belts, men's underwear, men's clothing, like 24 to 34 waist, new or gently used. And we're asking people to bring these donations to the center next Saturday between the hours of 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. We're going to be set out there with some tables, maybe a little bit of music. Social distancing is going to be required. Please bring your mask. But yeah, people can, if they can have any of these things lying around or they want to go buy some donations for this drive, we'll be out there next Saturday.
Hmm. Sounds like you're already serving the homeless. This is you're looking at homeless youth right now, right?
Most definitely, yeah.
How many do you think there are in Chico? Do you have any idea?
Well, I do not. I do not, and as any Chicoan driving down the street will tell you, like, it's prevalent in this town.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes. And you know, like, I don't have a solution, you know, but I know that every little bit helps. And so people, we'll be down there. It's at 130 West 6th Street, downtown Chico. Yeah.
Okay, so again, that's next Saturday, and if my mind was working more clearly, I could tell you what the date was, but maybe you know.
The
19th. The 19th. Okay, great.
Yes, ma'am.
And that's 10 to 2 at the 6th Street Center, which is at mm-hmm. 130 West 6th Street. So, listeners, if you've been wondering what you can do for unhoused people, this is a great project for you to bring stuff forward to this group for the work that they're doing. You know, I know that as well as being an activist in helping others, you know, paying back, giving so much of yourself in this way, you're also engaged in a studio, greenhouse studio. Can you talk about your work as an artist or an entrepreneur of art or however you define yourself, Benny Gutierrez?
Yes, ma'am. So I am an artist of sorts, mediocre at best, but I do have an eye for art. Well, it all stems through the murder of George Floyd. When that happened last May, I was contacted by a former classmate of mine. We were in an art class together at Butte, and we both wanted to do something. And so we put together a Black Lives Matter art show. And it was right in the midst of quarantine, and so, like, 1078, you know, Monca, everything else is closed. And so I just opened my backyard, and we set up some panels outside, and we were able to raise over $2,000 for a color change through this art show. And then after the art show, my partner and I decided to stay together and continue working together, and we've put on several art shows since. They're available. You could see them either at Greenhouse Studio on Facebook. We're more active on Instagram, greenhouse.studio, if anybody's interested. And yeah, we just did a show a couple weeks ago, and it was very safe and successful.
Can we back up to who Color of Change is, who you did the fundraiser in July for?
Yeah, Color of Change is a national organization who they support all issues of Black Lives Matter, and specifically legislation, like legislation that's going to actually affect real change in the country. And so we decided to help them out in their cause.
So that is incredible. It's so great that you were able to raise that much money and at a critical time. And going forward, do you have any openings coming up or any announcements you want to make about, or are you kind of quieted down now that it's going to be indoor time here for a while?
So as the cases continue to rise and and we're receiving more orders of quarantine and staying home orders, we just don't think it's a good idea to have a bunch of people congregating at one time. So we're going to just go ahead and step back from any live showings for now, but we're continuing to post all the time on our Instagram. We have art for sale, original pieces. We have prints for sale. We have a bunch of different art and art pieces for sale. And that's what we're doing. We're going to do that until it's safe to open up. But we can't wait to open up. And we love the support that we've received so far from the community. Last time we partnered with Mockingbird Coffee. They brought their trailer out here, and it was just a good time, a good experience. People coming together for the love of art and for good causes. And so you can expect more of that from us in the future, certainly as soon as the quarantine's done.
Yeah, and I've been to the gallery, and it is a wonderful little spot that you have there. So I do hope people will keep in the back of their minds, even if they're not physically there, Greenhouse Studio as a place for art. I also wanted to give a shout out to your partner, Natalie. She is also an activist. I note here that as a teenager, she partnered with her childhood friend to create purses for primates, responsible for raising over $14,000 to release orangutans back into their natural habitat, which is good work as far as I'm concerned.
It's great work. And we are a unique pair, to say the least. Like, you know, I'm formerly incarcerated, tattoos all over the place. And she's done, I don't know, it's just a perfect match. And the spirit is the same, and the spirit to affect change in the world is the same. And yeah, I really appreciate working with her and having her around, for sure.
You know, I have you for another 5 minutes, and then we've covered the topics that we wanted to cover. I'm speaking to Benny Gutierrez, and he is a formerly incarcerated person, and is pretty open about that. Has done so much work at Butte College with the Ascending Scholars Group, as you've just heard if you've been listening. But I'd like to get, you know, yesterday I couldn't sleep because they executed a man who committed a crime when he was 18 years old. He was black, he was poor, and he died last night at the hands of the state. And I was wondering, from your point of view, what are your thoughts on the death penalty and about the prison industrial complex and where we need to go? I know it's a big question, but since we have the time, I'd like to hear more what your thoughts are.
Well, I mean, I, for one, having known that, I was a part of the prison system when it was just CDC, and now they added an R to it, California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, but that's a joke. And many of the programs that come into prison to help us are self-funded. They have job security. They have no intention of, I'm talking about the prison itself and the cheap labor that they give. I mean, I have 1,000 words I want to say right now, and we have 4 minutes. But the truth of the matter is it's not working. It's clearly not working. There has to be another way to exact justice. And so, like, the model that I'm more familiar with is restorative justice and bringing people to the table, and certainly anti. Death penalty is something that needs to go away. Hopefully it'll go away with this next administration. Yeah, I don't know. You just got me all worked up, and like I know we have very little time to talk about it. And I wish at our next interview.
Yeah, it's not very kind to throw stuff at people. What would you like to tell people about, if you had 3 minutes, what would you like to talk about to the people of Chico? Would you like to address homelessness? Because this is a big one for me.
Yeah, like I said earlier, too, like, I have no, growing up here in this town, like, it did not exist when I was a kid. And, you know, and I live right next to a creek. You've been here. I live right next to a creek. And it's littered with trash. And so certainly I don't like that, you know, but like there has to be a more humane way of dealing with the situation. It's so multifaceted that there's just not one silver bullet that's going to, you know, cure this. And so I'm not the one making the decisions. And I just want to be out here in support of my fellow human beings. You know, especially now during this, during the winter time, and I just urge all Chicoans to do the same.
Yeah, so, well, I think what you're saying is that do what you can, and then, unfortunately, our city council now, the very first thing they did was to recriminalize the homeless, infraction or a misdemeanor to camp along any waterways or in a park. And, of course, there's no place. They have not found a place for them to go, and we can't do safe space this winter because of COVID. It's hard to have settings where you have a lot of people in one space, so it's become very intractable, especially since the city council ran the slate that won. They ran on an anti-homeless platform, so they, of course, that was the first thing that they did, but now they can't. I don't think they can do it. I think it's illegal to move the homeless during COVID, you know, when there's a stay-at-home order in place. So,
definitely.
So along with that, I do want to tell people that the next city council meeting is December 15th, and it is important that if you can't attend, which I don't know how they're going to be running them, probably online, but you can write letters to the city council and put pressure on the city manager, Mark Orme. He's the pivotal person in all this. He's sort of the czar of what's happened in Chico. So that would be my recommendation. Benny Gutierrez, I want to thank you for the projects that you're doing. Let's recap for people who might have joined us late. Go ahead and tell us what you're fundraising for, please.
I'm fundraising on Facebook at Ascending Scholars on Facebook, and we're fundraising you can see the flyer there for the GoFundMe for the care packages to the fellas inside prisons. And also right now we're doing a winter necessities drive. Ascending Scholars is doing a winter necessities drive, and we'll be out there at 6th Street next Saturday the 19th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. And we have a whole list of items we're asking the community to donate, particularly high protein non-perishables and wet weather gear. And yeah, we would appreciate everybody coming out and bringing something. At least a smile or something behind your mask.
yeah, in your eyes. So, Benny Gutierrez, thank you so much for your work. I really appreciate you being in the same community with me. I feel very lucky to know you.
And I feel lucky to know you. Thank you. And all your listeners. Thanks to all your listeners.
All right. Peace to you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. This is the Peace and Justice Program. We are on every Friday from 11:30 to 1. And our underwriters are key to making the station succeed during this difficult time. So I'm asking everyone to support our underwriters and local businesses before you even think about going online. And starting with Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. and also Chico Velo, supporting bicycling, education, and advocacy since 1980. Chico Velo encourages you to ride your bicycle and park it safely at their bike valet when available at the Thursday night market and the Saturday farmers market. For more information, visit chicovelo.org and find them on Facebook. So have a couple of seconds here before the top of the hour, and there's much going on, and I just want to read you a couple things here, if I can get at it. All right, so I want to let you know that the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons will enter into force on January 22nd, 2021. It will be binding, and so all nuclear weapons will become illegal at that time. So that is something to celebrate, as that is one of the great existential threats with climate change that threatens all of our lives in the background of all the crazy stuff that we are living in and accountable for. Staying safe from annihilation is one of them. And then there's also something I thought was important this week. Poor People's Campaign came out with 14 policy priorities to heal the nation, a moral and economic agenda for the first 100 days. And they expand on these, but I'm just going to read you the topics, and you can go go on their website to learn more, the Poor People's Campaign. Okay, so enact comprehensive, free, and just COVID-19 relief, guarantee quality health care for all, regardless of any pre-existing conditions, raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour immediately, update the poverty measure, I'm not sure what that is, guarantee quality housing for all, enact a federal jobs program to build up investments, infrastructure, public institutions, climate resilience, energy efficiency, and socially beneficial industries and jobs in poor and low-income communities. Protect and expand voting rights and civil rights. Guarantee safe, quality, and equitable public education with supports for protection against resegregation. Comprehensive and just immigration reform. Ensure all of the rights of Indigenous peoples. Enact fair taxes. Use the power of executive orders. Redirect the bloated Pentagon budget toward these priorities as matters of national security. Work with the Poor People's Campaign to establish a permanent presidential council to advocate for this bold agenda. So that is pretty exciting. And I hope that you will look into them more, because they really focus on these big picture things, and they've been working on it very hard. So it is coming up on the top of the hour now. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. It is noon. The Peace and Justice Program is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the local, seasonal, and organic offerings at Farm Star Pizza, where the farmer is the star. Farm Star features artisan pizzas, salads, appetizers, and desserts. They have vegan and gluten-free offerings, craft beer, and eclectic wines. Farm Star Pizza is open 7 days a week for to-go lunch and dinner orders. Find Farm Star Pizza at 2359 The Esplanade, at farmstarpizza.com, and on Facebook. The telephone number is 343-2056. And by the TLC Affordable Fashion, providing families affordable access to brand-name clothing. TLC Affordable Fashion is open 7 days a week in the old Sears building on Forest Avenue at the Chico Mall, and gives a percentage of sales each month to local nonprofits. This month's group is the Salvation Army, and you can find out details on Facebook, TLC Stores, it's called on Facebook. So, got through all of that pretty quickly, and I'm grateful, because my next guest, I wanted to give him a full hour. He is an incredible person, like all my guests are, I'm grateful to say. He's just written a book called Our 60s, An Activist History by Paul Lauder. And I'm going to play a Nina Simone song. This is from Best of Nina Simone. Came out in 1970, but the songs have to do with that period of time. I was able to see her in Central Park during the 60s, so she's somebody that came to mind as an activist herself. And then I'll get Dr. Lauder on the phone here. Here we go.
course, this whole program is dedicated to the memory of Dr. Martin Luther King. You know that, anyway. Once upon this planet Earth lived a man of humble birth, preaching love and freedom for his fellow man. He was dreaming of the day peace would come to Earth to stay, and he spread this message all across the land. Turn the other cheek, he'd plead. Love thy neighbor was his creed. Pain, humiliation, death, he did not dread. With his Bible at his side, from his foes he did not hide. It's hard to think that this great man is dead.
Nina Simone, the great Nina Simone. I have on the line with me Dr. Paul Lauder. He is a former president of the National American Studies Association. He is the general editor of the, he has been the general editor of the groundbreaking Heath Anthology of American Literature, now in its seventh edition. He, in the 1960s, Lauder served as Peace Education Secretary and Director of Peace Studies in the American Friends Service Committee and Executive Director of the U.S. Servicemen's Fund. He worked in Freedom Schools in Mississippi in Roosevelt University's Upward Bound program and was director of the first community school project in the nation. He also was one of the founders of the Feminist Press and its treasurer and editor for 14 years. Dr. Lauder taught at Trinity College from 1988 until his retirement in 2015, serving for many years as director of American Studies on the English Department chair and the director of the graduate program in American Studies. We're going to be speaking about his new book, Our 60s, An Activist History. And Dr. Lauder was an active participant, as you will soon hear. And for some people, the cultural decade of the 60s was loosely defined from the more commonly than the actual decade, beginning around 63 or 64 with the John Kennedy assassination and the Beatles' arrival in the United States, and ending in around 69-70 with the Altamont Rolling Stone concert and the Kansas State shootings. So the 60s are generally remembered as an era of freedom, innovation, and visionary experience, a time for hippie dreams of a countercultural revolution, but also, for many of us, a forceful decade for civil rights and a terrible war that scarred a generation. And this book, Our 60s, An Activist History, Noam Chomsky writes that our guest, Paul Lauder's Our 60s, is a gripping portrayal of a dramatic era from the unique perspective of a keen observer, astute analyst, and direct participant in all of its complex stages. And we'd like to welcome you to the Peace and Justice Program here in Chico, California. Hi, Dr. Lauder.
Hi. Oh, it's wonderful to Peace and Justice Program. I love it.
Yeah, I know. I love it too. And I, you know, it's a rare thing. But in these days of COVID, luckily, more people have time to speak with me. So I've had just such incredible experiences with guests here over the years. You know, I wanted to kind of take this book chronologically because there's so many important nuggets in here, Dr. Lauder. And because our lives, you're a little older than me, but our lives paralleled through the 60s. And some of the things that are most important that jump out to me are because of my understanding of them that I kind of sync with you on. Your first political act, your coming out, was in 1960 when you were doing a Ban the Bomb Leaf Fielding with Sane outside the presentation of On the Beach. So can you describe for us about Ban the Bomb Leafleting? Why was that necessary? What was Sane and what was On the Beach? Tell us about that period of time.
Yeah, well, On the Beach was a film that actually came out at the very end of 59, right before Christmas. And really it's about the end of the human race after nuclear or atomic war, as it was called at the time. It had very mixed reviews, but it really provided an opportunity for people who wanted to see an end to nuclear testing and a change away from what was called MAD, mutually assured destruction, to a more peaceful international relationship, set of relationships. And so the Sane Nuclear Policy Committee was one of the main sources of opposition to the ongoing nuclear testing. Ben Spock, Dr. Spock, was involved with it. One of the more famous ads of the period was Dr. Spock is worried. What he was worried about was fallout. But he was also worried about warfare and what could happen by mischance or deliberation, whatever. Anyway, the Sane Nuclear Policy Committee had branches in all sorts of places. I was teaching that year in 59-60 at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And I really had done a little bit of what we would call movement work before that, thanks to a graduate school buddy, Alan Brick, who passed away last year. Alan was a pacifist. He had served as a conscientious objector. He, for his alternative service, he taught in a girls' reformatory, actually, outside Philadelphia, as I recall. And we were in graduate school together at Yale late in the 50s. And as things happened, we both ended up at Dartmouth, and as our first full-time jobs. And Alan was an active pacifist. He didn't simply sit on his laurels as a conscientious objector. One of the things he did was to recruit people to the work of bringing about peace. And one of the things he did, I remember, was to post posters addressed to men of draft age to tell them that they might be conscientious objectors. They were not very good posters at the time. We changed them a few years later. He and I, following him, sort of, we post these posters around in Hanover, which they often rapidly got pulled down, but there it was. He also got A.J. Musty, who was an important force for 40 or 50 years as a pacifist, as a socialist, lots of other ways. A.J. was the person who wrote a very important pamphlet called Speak Truth to Power. And that phrase is a familiar one now, but it certainly wasn't in the 50s and 60s. I remember Alan inviting A.J. to talk, and the unhappiness of some of the Dartmouth kids about this radical coming and talking. But in any case, Alan really got me started in that direction. And when I left Dartmouth to go teach at the University of Massachusetts, there were two people there who kept me going. One was Jules Chemetsky, who is still alive and still active in things, and Sid Kaplan, whose work I didn't know at the time at all, but it was a very, very important work that had to do with the writing of Herman Melville and Melville's writing that concerned questions of race. Sid and Jules Chemetsky were active in one of the first university teachers' unions, which I joined there in 59, and I think that they were probably active also in the same Nuclear Policy Committee. And so we or they or whoever decided that when On the Beach was going to be shown in Amherst, that we would leaflet with a leaflet calling for an end to nuclear testing and a change in foreign policy to one that was less confrontational with the Soviet Union. And you're right in saying that it was sort of coming out, because it's a very different thing to hand out leaflets in the street, as it were, outside the movie house to people that you didn't know but who might know you. And there was no hiding anymore. Your politics were out front. And it really made a difference in the way in which I regarded things. It's sort of like now, you know, somebody goes out on a demonstration. They don't really think about it until you're out there in the demonstration, and suddenly, you know, there are cops, there are counter demonstrators, this, that, and the other thing, and suddenly you realize you're in a different situation. It really is a coming out experience, and that analogy to gay life, coming out, is really, I think, a purposeful and meaningful analogy, because you suddenly see things differently. And people see you differently, and that's part of the process. Anyway, we leafleted there at On the Beach in early, I think it was early 1960.
Right, and you know, I have to just remind people that in the early 60s, we were in a Cold War, a post World War II Cold War with the Soviet Union, in 1962 was Cuban Missile Crisis. All of us had we had bunkers in our basements in those days, and it was a very intense period. And some of this work that you did continued, you know, was important in terms of setting the framework for the peace movement that, you know, fought above ground nuclear testing and the whole anti-nuclear movement, which continues to this day.
Yes.
I mean, we have so much to cover. I'm going to ask for shorter answers now.
Okay.
So we can get through the 60s. You know, you had some really interesting shifts in your life, and your divorce was maybe the best thing that ever happened to you from your first wife, because then you became the Peace Studies Director for the American Friends Service Committee in 1963, and they were very, very important during the 60s, and your role there was critical to their work. So can you talk about that?
Yeah, the American Friends Service Committee, the AFSC, was one of a very few pacifist organizations. The Fellowship of Reconciliation was another, that played a very significant role in the early years of the development of a peace movement. There wasn't a peace movement, let's face it, in 1960 or 62. There was SANE, there was the AFSC, and there weren't demonstrations. There was a war already going on, in fact, in Vietnam, but who ever heard of it? Nobody. When it became clear that my marriage was breaking up, Alan Brick, the same Alan who had been my graduate school buddy and with whom I taught at Dartmouth, suggested that I might be interested in going to work for the American Friends Service Committee in Philadelphia as the director of Peace Studies. Peace Studies was essentially a program to develop and get around pamphlets that had to do with trying to develop alternatives to the kind of international relationships that of the Cold War. Beyond Deterrence was what the series was called, and its purpose was beyond deterrence. Deterrence was the big military idea of the time. So I moved myself to Philadelphia and became the director of Peace Studies, and I learned what I was doing largely from the guy who was the associate to my program. Martin Oppenheimer, who was a sociologist and who's still around, and he and another guy, George Lakey, wrote an important pamphlet about nonviolent direct action. In any case, the program was national in scope because of the American Friends Service Committee had offices in Boston, in Cambridge, in Chicago, in San Francisco, in Seattle, all over. And part of the idea was to see how our pamphlets in the Beyond Deterrence series could be used, and how they could be used for organizing, how they could be used in classes, how they could be used in friends' meetings, and so forth and so on. And I went around and held little seminars, talked with people in half-a-seat offices and on university campuses, and did that sort of thing, recruited additional pamphlets, and did one other thing that was sort of beyond the initial scope of the program, and that was to hold a conference on teaching about peace issues, which we held at what was the Uptown campus of New York University in the Bronx in the spring of 1964. It was the first time for me that I tried to figure out, look, you've got courses on military history and on war. What about courses on peace, on conflict resolution, on similar kinds of different ways of thinking about things? And so we had this conference. There are floating around copies of the material we got together for that conference. At least for me, and I think for some other people, it was a significant moment, because we began to think about how we could bring about change in university curriculum and in the ways in which people thought about and actually taught. And that's what we did.
So I'm speaking with Paul Lauder. He is the author of Our 60s, an Activist History. You know, I wanted to move to the pivotal year. I think the pivotal year of your life, from looking at this book, was when you went to Mississippi and participated in the Freedom Schools. Here you were. You were 30-something, white Jewish man from urban New York. You hadn't any experience with African-American people, who were called Negroes at that point.
Right.
And there you were, going to be teaching. So tell us about the Freedom Schools.
Well, SNCC primarily, but SNCC? Also CORE and the NAACP, put together a kind of a overarching unit called the Conference of Federated Organizations, COFO, which had an office in Jackson and offices elsewhere. And what they did, they had a variety of projects. One of the most important, perhaps, was the one to try to register black people to vote, which had been a very dangerous process and continued to be. I mean, people were literally killed trying to register. But they also decided to have these freedom schools in cities and towns throughout Mississippi. And the idea of the freedom school is contained in the title, Freedom School. It was schooling about freedom. How do you gain a sense of your own efficacy and your own potential power? How do you change things so that segregation does not dominate your life? And of course, black people in Mississippi had been pushing against segregation for many years, and particularly in the previous 3 or 4 years, 1959, 60, 61, and so forth, when after the sit-ins, when SNCC came into being, it was a very strange experience in some ways for me, because, as you said correctly, I had no experience with black people. I grew up in New York City, but in my part of Manhattan and Washington Heights, it was entirely white, you really did not pay very much attention to black Harlem, which was only a couple miles away. And it was only when I was working at the American Friends Service Committee in Philadelphia that other people got me interested in the issues of race, particularly a friend of mine, Barbara Hinchcliffe, who worked for the AFSC as well. And she got me to drive down to Chester, Pennsylvania, just south of Philly. We participated in some nightly marches from the black section of Chester into downtown Chester, mainly from my point of view at the time, to support a young guy who had changed his name to Muhammad Kenyatta, who was picketing stores in downtown Chester, saying to people, don't shop where you can't work, because Chester stores would not hire blacks. And this began to get me interested in the issues of that I knew nothing about. And then when I was traveling for the American Friends Service Committee, one of the places I stopped at on one trip was Atlanta, where I met Howard Zinn and Staunton Lind. And Howard and Staunton, of course, were very active with SNCC, and were active planning the summer program, the Mississippi Summer in 1964. And they said, well, why don't you come and be part of this? Yes, they explained what the possibilities were. And so I did become part of it with a woman I never quite married, but was married to, Lawrence Howe, who passed away recently. Anyway, we took the bus from Baltimore to Jackson, Mississippi. Florence was asked to start up a freedom school in Jackson. I went around throughout the state with movies on nonviolence, on Dr. King, on Gandhi, and I would show a film and lead a discussion, and I began to get a sense of what the world was seen through the eyes of young black men and women in the deep segregationist South. And it was just an amazing experience. It's very hard to communicate that to people nowadays, to understand how kids that I was trying to teach saw the world. And I began to learn from them. I had to learn from them in order to have anything to say to them. And the world that they saw was a segregationist world from which they were being excluded and marginalized. And the best that they could look to for a lot of it, particularly the guys, was to go in the army, get out of Mississippi. And it was a profound learning experience for me. I mean, I had a PhD. I had been teaching in three colleges. I thought I knew what I was doing. I had read Negro novelists, as they were called, you know, James Baldwin, Ralph Ellison, and Richard Wright, and that's all I knew. And it's amazing to me the level of ignorance that I and many others among the young volunteers that came to Mississippi that summer had. Yes, we were teachers in freedom schools, but we were learning. We were learning what life was about for black Americans. And that experience, really, in 1964, you're quite right, shaped my future entirely. It suddenly seemed very different to think about things from the perspective, insofar as I could understand that perspective of these young black kids who were defying segregation, defying jail, defying threats and violence, and changing things, making change. And that led me to the next series of years of going back to full-time teaching for a year at Smith, and then going back to work with the American Friends Service Committee, and then going back to teaching, and then going to work for the U.S. Servicemen's Fund, but always keeping involved in the movement. That really came out of the experience of Mississippi in 64.
And for the rest of us, we were watching it on TV. We were seeing the water cannons and the cruelty and the dogs and really taken up with it. In 1965, for a lot of us, we attended teach-ins that were held all across the country about the widening war in Indochina. And you were, at that point, more and more involved with organizing against the draft. And
yes,
this work, I think, was really important because people nowadays they don't know about a draft. They hardly even know about registration. But talk about that, please.
Yeah. I thought, and others at the time, that the way to sort of cut off the war machine was to cut off its access to young American guys, because the draft at that point involved only men. It turned out that was not the case in the long run, but in the short run, what we began to do was, like the poster I mentioned before, men of draft age who may be conscientious objectors to war, began to talk to young guys about what their values were and how their values matched up or did not match up with American foreign policy, particularly as manifest in Vietnam, and the growing peace movement. You know, the first real significant demonstration against the war in Vietnam, 1965 in Washington, just a few weeks after the Marines had landed on the beach in Da Nang in Vietnam. And so we developed a whole draft counseling program. I had gone by that time back to work for the American Friends Service Committee in Chicago as the Peace Education Secretary, as it was called. And that opened up all sorts of possibilities. I did some work with people in unions who were against the war, but that was a long shot because the AFL-CIO at the time was supportive of the war. And it seemed to me that the best approach was to talk with young people and to provide them with what they needed to think about the war and to think about their own position. And underlying all of that was the hope, the aspiration, that more and more young people, young guys in particular, would say no. There's a new film out that just, I think it's now available, The Boys Who Said No. Well, they ranged from the guys who would not even register to guys who said they're not going to be drafted to others who applied for conscientious objector status to others who went to Canada. A great variety of positions, and that's the work that we were doing in Chicago at the AFSC. We put out lots of literature. We held counseling sessions. We recruited lawyers to help guys who were opposing the draft and would not agree to be drafted. We did a whole variety of things.
Yeah.
This was a period from 65 to roughly to 68. I was involved in Chicago until 67.
Yeah, and it seemed like no matter what lottery or anything they did to try to make it fair, that it was poor people of color that carried that war on their backs. But I want to reintroduce you. I'm speaking with the author of Our 60s, an Activist History, which came out this October. I'm speaking with Paul Lauder. This is Chris. It's a Peace and Justice program here at your community radio station, KZFR. We're talking about the 60s, and we're just about almost eking through to 1967. And there was a lot of strain that I remember in the movement, because it was pretty much run by white males. And at this conference, they brought up the conflicting goals and intent and made attempts to unify civil rights, black power, anti-war, new left, and the quote-unquote women problem. But this was white males doing it. So tell us a little bit about some of the strains. I mean, I was always very much aware of the difference between the Students for Democratic Society, SDS position versus the American Friends Service Committee, Martin Luther King Jr. versus Stokely Carmichael, Malcolm X. There was a lot of different ways that people saw things, and people nowadays don't even understand about how Martin Luther King Jr. was not well thought of by many, many more radical black activists. So talk about those strains in the 60s between activists and what was emerging at that time.
Well, King King was an altogether remarkable human being. You know, he insisted on the disciplines of nonviolence, and that did not mean, as it turned out, as I learned in 64 and certainly in 65, that there would not be any effort to protect yourself. Nonviolence was, for him, a way of life, as it had been for Gandhi before that, and Thoreau talked about it in Civil Disobedience. King would carry out these campaigns. I knew him when he was carrying out that campaign in Chicago to integrate housing and to build housing that was not segregated. Chicago was an enormously segregated city, as were most northern cities, in fact.
Right.
On the other hand, there were people like Stokely who emphasized other things. Black power was one of his mantras. But I can tell you by personal experience that when we went around to the freedom schools in rural areas of Mississippi in 64, there were people, black guys, with guns outside where we were sleeping. We would not have survived if there had not been that kind of armed defense. We didn't talk about it very much, and we certainly didn't talk about it very much in 64, much more so in 65. And it wasn't that there was an effort to pick up the gun, and as some people in the movement talked about it. These were older men, any of them with military experience, who simply, in effect, said, "You're going to have to come through us if you're going to attack these volunteers and these people teaching in the freedom schools, or in '65, the people making a film called Black Natchez." They protected, and it wasn't so much that there were those kinds of strains and stresses. There were in the movement, but there were different ideas about what your particular role was, what your emphasis needed to be. That was somewhat different from what came about a little bit later. You mentioned the National Conference for New Politics in 1967, which was an effort to bring together civil rights and anti-war work to which the women's movement, which was barely starting at that point, was seen as quite marginal. But the truth of the matter was, there was not a basis at that point in 1967. There were divisions. How could a program to emphasize housing for African Americans impact the ongoing war on Vietnam? And people did not have answers for those questions at that point. And on the contrary, there was a lot of feeling that, well, you know, racism is one thing and the war is another. I think that's changed profoundly now.
Yeah, I think people really now are focusing on intersectionalism. It's really become a very, very important.
Yes.
I just want to reintroduce you one more time This is Dr. Paul Lauder. He is the author of R60s and Activist History. I hope you'll all stay tuned at 1 o'clock for Playing Dead. We're talking about the 60s, and for me, the most bitter year was 1967. I was in Newark, New Jersey. I was there during what they called riots, but it was an uprising. And I just wanted to get the tone here about how bitter it was during that war in Vietnam, how it bled into our lives and hurt us. And you say in the book, on this particular page, talking about it's resisting, chapter 8, I wish I had a way to get this page physically hot, to make my readers feel the fury with which I thought about the president, his advisors, the generals, and yes, even the Marine privates who are making Vietnam a place of torment and misery. And this is at the point where the call to resist illegitimate authority was published, and you have it in as an appendix in the book. And I was wondering if you could talk about 1967 and the intensity of that year.
Well, you know, between 65 and 67, actually 68, people had done all sorts of things to try to change the American policy in Vietnam. And we learned more and more about it. The New York Times ran a daily count of casualties, American casualties, not Vietnamese. You could see the use of defoliants and of all sorts of military bombs on peasants and on cows in the field, and it was just awful. And everything we tried to do, like support conscientious objection, draft resistance, nothing worked. Nothing seemed to make any significant difference. So a number of people, Chomsky being one of them, and people from the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, like Mark Raskin and Arthur Waskow or others, and the critical person actually was Robert Zevin, who was then an economics professor at Columbia. They thought, all right, let's pull together a call to resist and say, we will commit civil disobedience, we will counsel young men to refuse to go in the military, to reject war, and if you put us in jail, you'll put us in jail. It was modeled on a similar kind of call to resist by French intellectuals during the Algerian War. And I got involved. I had talked with Chomsky about the desirability of such a call, and we published the call in the New York Review of Books, as I recall, and I think in the New Republic, maybe the Nation. And we thought, well, this will make a difference. Well, it didn't. Not directly, not immediately, but it was part of a process of building larger and larger opposition to the war. I mean, you started with maybe 25,000 people at the first demonstration in Washington in 65, and by 67 and 68, you'd have a demonstration of 1 million. And all sorts of other things going on. And so much of it had to do with what you identified, the rage, the sense that this was a government out of control, that they were not paying any attention to the needs of our own people. When Dr. King came out against the war in the speech that he made, a year before he was murdered,
yes,
he said, instead of sending black kids to a place 8,000 or 10,000 miles away to kill Vietnamese, why not be supporting their efforts to change Mississippi and Alabama and Louisiana and so forth? And yet the government seemed just out of control. And it was almost... The more the things went on, the less you felt that you had efficacy to change things. Now, that wasn't true, in fact, as we now really know. Nixon may have resisted assembling of people outside the White House and the Green in Washington, but he knew.
Yes.
That things were building. And that continued.
Yeah, it took a long time. A disappointing
really
long time. But in order to complete this mission of the 60s, I would like to talk about the women's movement. You were an exceptional human being because you were amazing in being everywhere. And as one of the... your participation in the feminist press, please.
Well, we were living in Baltimore, Florence and I. We had moved from Washington to Baltimore, and we were involved with the movement there. And the movement in Baltimore was very interesting because it had a journal, Women's Journal of Liberation. It had an active... peace organization, the Baltimore Defense Committee. It had a number of people who were active on issues of racism, both in Baltimore and Baltimore County and on the eastern shore of Maryland. So that it was a very, in a sense, a very progressive place to be in. And in the summer of 1970, we took a little vacation, went up to Cape Cod, as I recall. But before we went, we had talked with people about the possibility of doing some useful work for the then just beginning to develop women's movement. And somebody put a notice, I think, in the magazine, Women, a Journal of Liberation, or in a newsletter from the Baltimore Defense Committee, or maybe both. In any case, when we got back, we had a ton of mail from people who were saying, yes, we need to start a new press, a new educational effort to support the education and change the education of women, because we had begun to know by then that women's education, like at Smith, when I taught at Smith in 1964-65, there was an introductory English department course that was all male and all white, and it's not that the books were bad books. Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. But they really did not speak in any direct way to the lives of the young women there at Smith. And that was true throughout the country. So we wanted to start what would be an educational publishing house. We had no idea what we were doing. We had no experience in publishing. We had just the faintest idea of how you put an organization of this sort together. Well, you know, what you did when people were saying we have to start this, you held a meeting. And the first meeting was what I write about in our 60s. The first meeting was in our house in Baltimore. Lots and lots of people came. We thought that, you know, 10 or 12 people would come. Well, it was 40 or 50. And it went on from there. We decided that we would have biographies of not necessarily altogether forgotten women, but they were forgotten, like Elizabeth Blackwell, first woman doctor in the United States. And that we would have children's books. And ultimately that we would publish works by women writers that had indeed been largely forgotten, like The Yellow Wallpaper, or Rebecca Harding Davis's Life in the Iron Mills. We decided to turn over one of the bedrooms in our house. We had a big house, big cheap house. I think we paid $27,000 for it in Baltimore. And the office of what we began to call the feminist press was there. And I obviously, just by force of circumstance, as well as interest and commitment, began to participate in that and did so for many years, both as an editor and as the treasurer of the feminist press. And I would go to meetings and set up a book display as we began to actually publish books and get them around. And it was an enormously stimulating and an interesting process because, yeah, I was a man in the women's movement, and I had to learn my place. There were certain circumstances where I would be welcomed and others where I would not be.
You know, I want to stop you there because we have 3 minutes left, and there's so much that I wanted to cover beyond that, because you went on to write this canon of American literature, which was very informed by all of your experiences, but especially your experiences with Freedom Summer, the Heath Anthology. And you also have continued to archive information from the 60s. You've taught courses on them. There's a syllabus in our 60s and activist history. And you were sort of the go-to person, I think, for information about the 60s because you have this incredible retention about it. In the last 2 minutes that we have, I would like you to summarize the 60s. And I can't say summarize your life work because it's just... people are just going to have to look you up. His spelling of your last name is Lauter, Paul Lauter. Just wrap this all up for us if you can. I know it's difficult. I'm sorry.
Well, it was a time of intensity, experimental, insistent. I love seeing... and occasionally have participated in Black Lives Matter because it has that same spirit, that sense that things the way they are cannot continue to be the way they are. They have to change. And we're not going to ask somebody else to change these things. We are going to insist, and we are going to put ourselves out there to make these changes. This is not to say that we didn't make mistakes. We did. We made all sorts of mistakes. But on the other hand, we forced the issues. Like you just could not go back in the closet, as it were. Once you were out, once you were insistent on change, and that's what the 60s were about. From my perspective, bringing about a changed society. Now, it is true, we took one step backward, but now again, there are two steps forward. And I think it's that sense of intensity. We cannot allow things to continue the way they are. They have to change. And we are going to put ourselves on the line in order to change these things. And that it's not a matter of one thing at a time. Oh, we'll deal with race this year, and next year we'll deal with war, and next year we'll deal with women's issues and so forth. All of these things are part of a change in who runs the society, for whose benefit, and how it has to change so that we don't have things happening as we do now, where African-American communities and Latina communities are so assaulted by the virus in ways that are unimaginable to people who don't understand the history of racism in this country. So that's what the 60s were for me, a period of intensity, a period of change, a period of learning. And the question always was, how can we apply what we learn to the things that we do, whether it's teaching or whether it's medicine or whether it's politics or all of them.
Thank you so much, Dr. Paul Lauder. Thank you for this book, Our 60s in Activist History, and for your life of service to humanity. I really appreciate you, and please stay well.
You too. Thank you so much for having me here.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Chris.
All right. So, it's actually very poignant. Dr. Lauder isn't well, and he's an amazing person, so I hope that you will check out his work. I want to get into this Heath anthology, that he has written. He's a very prolific author. All right, so I just want to let you know that Peace and Justice will be on next week with Reverend Jesse Kearns, my co-host, and on Christmas Day we'll be away, so you'll be hearing Radio Paradise in this slot. And then on New Year's Day, please come back to us. There will be a Sapient session with Corey Hemp Hunt in celebration of the memory of Desmond Phillips on Desmond's birthday. So let's go to the community calendar. Stay tuned, as I said, to Playing Dead. Please stay well. Happy Hanukkah. Everything you celebrate, I celebrate with you, and I celebrate you, and love you all very much. I'll talk to you next year.
Oh, don't you ever run dry.
90.1 KZFR is celebrating 30 years of broadcasting. Chico's own Sierra Nevada Brewing Company has brewed a 30th anniversary ale to celebrate. There are only 10 cases left in existence. KZFR will have an online auction. Each auction will include one case of anniversary ale, one anniversary ale t-shirt, one Sierra Nevada Brewing Company keychain, one KZFR coaster, and one pair of KZFR sunglasses.
Bless my lips when that bottle tips. I wish I had a Sierra Nevada. I wish I had a Sierra Nevada.
KZFR.org for more details and to place your bid in the auction. Thank you to Sierra Nevada Brewing Company for making our 30th anniversary ale. And cheers to 30 years from 90.1 KZFR, Chico, California. More details online at KZFR.org.
Hey, KZFR listeners, it's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar. I'm Matt Fidler. Chico Performances announced a series of special virtual performances for the holiday season. Tickets for the holiday shows, as well as all Chico Performances shows, are available at chicoperformances.com or by calling 530-898-6333. Or at the university box office on campus. Last Friday, December 4th, the Chico Voices virtual season continued with the premiere of the Yule Log streaming concert event from the stage of Chico State's Laxon Auditorium. The Yule Logs are the self-described hardest working band in snow business. The concert event will be available on demand through December 31st for the 48-hour rental. Tickets for the on-demand rental are available at chicoperformances.com. The ticket pricing is a pay-what-you-want model with a suggested $5 minimum to support the arts. Later in December, Chico Performances brings the world premiere performances of